This is Bloomberg Intelligence.
The new tools that a metaverse can bring allows you to create more immersive content.
Companies are beginning to sell less oil, more electrons.
In-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
The supply chain breakdown is combining with labor shortages.
Will Eastern manufacturers continue to dominate, or will there be a renewed interest in Western manufacturing?
Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Over the next hour, we will dig inside the big business stories impacting Wall Street and the global markets.
Each and every week, we provide in-depth research and data on some of the 2,000 companies and 130 industries our analysts cover worldwide.
Today, we take a look at the outlook for European real estate investment trusts.
Plus, Bitcoin futures ETFs. They've put the SEC between a rock and a hard place.
But first, we want to talk about the streaming wars. So, first of all, it was about profitability. Then it was about content. Then it was about profitability. Then it was about content. And there are a lot of players in this space, and there are a lot that dominate, and there are those that need to get in desperately very quickly. So let's get some more insight on this with Geetha Raghunathan, a Bloomberg Intelligence U.S. media analyst. The lay of the land, the winners, the leaders, the laggards.
Yeah. So I think this is finally shaping up to really be, a year of reckoning where we're kind of going to see that separation from the winners, the losers, the wannabes. I think we pretty much have already kind of seen it shape up into a two-horse race, if you will, between Netflix and Disney. But you cannot rule out Discovery, which still has a pending merger with Warner, through which it will acquire HBO Max and could become a top-tier player. And then, of course, you always have the dark horse, which is Amazon. So I think we're going to see kind of the market really shape up with these four or five mega players, if you will.
So, Geetha, let's talk about making money out of this business, because the media business that you and I grew up with was so profitable that they made so much money off of the cable companies because consumers would pay $100 a month for all this stuff.
You're so dating yourself.
I know. Now it's going to be a little bit different. Now the streaming economics. Give us a sense of the profitability of the streaming business, and do investors care?
They didn't care for the longest time. It was only all about subscribers, but now they do care. And we got a glimpse of that a little bit last year, Paul, when we kind of saw the whole media sector, perform and really underperform, especially in the second half. And that was really a combination of two things. So one is, that we did see a little bit of a slowness in the streaming subscriber growth story. You had the COVID bump and then a little bit of a stump following that. And then finally, now investors are really waking up to the fact that this is a tough business. It is tough because content costs are accelerating. There is very steep inflation in, per hour episode costs for scripted dramas, for scripted series, and content costs are accelerating. And if you really want to win the subscriber war, you have to be willing to write those big checks and take big swings, something that Netflix has not been afraid to do. And everybody now kind of finds themselves in the same situation where they have to be willing to do exactly what Netflix did. And just to give you some context, Netflix is spending about $17 billion this year. Disney actually just came out and said that they're going to be spending more than $30 billion in 2022. So yes, this is not for the faint-hearted. It requires a lot of investment. And investors are now starting to care about profits, but the only thing is that it's been very, very hard to make profits in the streaming world. And the only company that has been able to do that so far successfully has been Netflix. And so investors are going to increasingly judge all of these new entrants against Netflix, and I'm not so sure that all of them are going to be able to replicate that Netflix playbook.
So presumably not, right? So if that's the case, do investors want a pure play like Netflix? That's what Netflix is versus Disney, which is then theme parks and merchandise and like actual movies in movie theaters versus, say, Apple TV, which is phones. And this is just like an add-on like for Apple TV Plus. So I wonder, what do investors want more, the pure play or the integrated?
So I think towards the end of last year, we really saw that, the pure play kind of came back into focus just because the story is so clean over there. With Netflix, you know exactly what you're getting. This is really just a play on broadband connectivity across the world. We know that, the whole world is becoming more and more connected. We know that, the trend is that people are moving away from linear television towards internet-driven, streaming services. And Netflix is really at the forefront of that. So you get a really clean story And now we're also seeing with Netflix, what we're seeing is also this shift away from just subscriber metrics to more financial metrics. So in 2021, Netflix will deliver an operating margin of 20%. By 2025, we actually expect that to go up to 35%. And kind of what Paul alluded to earlier in the conversation where, you know, he spoke about the media business generating really healthy margins. 35% margins were the average number, and that's exactly where Netflix is getting to. So it's a really clean story. I think in the streaming world, I think definitely people do like the pure plays.
And Geetha, you know, it's kind of strange here. In the mix here, we have two companies, Apple TV and Amazon, with Amazon Prime. That's not their core business. I don't think they really care if they make any money with their video business. And that kind of scares me because then they can continue to drive up the programming costs in this industry. And the people that do need to show their investors profits, like a Disney, you know, like a Discovery, that could be a problem for them.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's an excellent point, Paul. And we've already actually seen Amazon already do that. So last year, if you remember, they bought MGM for almost $8.5 billion. They went after the NFL. They're already paying $13 billion for Thursday Night Football. So again, money is no object. They're, you know, very, very deep-pocketed players. And yeah, it's always a big risk for the rest of the media landscape if Apple decides to do something, you know, disruptive, maybe go after more sports programming or buy some of the smaller studios.
All right. Well, Geetha, thanks a lot. Really, really appreciate it. Geetha Ranganathan, a Bloomberg Intelligence U.S. media analyst.
Coming up on the program, European credit is set to get pummeled by rising yields in 2022. That's coming up.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 13 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
All right, we all know that interest rates are going up. It's not just here in the U.S., it's also around the globe. The ECB, the Bank of England, and others are raising their rates. How will credit do? Let's focus on some European credit. Mahesh Bimalingam joins us from Bloomberg Intelligence. He covers a strategy over there in Europe. So, Mahesh, give us a sense of where you think the opportunities are in fixed income, in credit, in 2022, assuming that rates are, in fact, going to be rising.
Yeah. I think one thing is for sure, if you ask any rate strategist or if you look at, you know, consensus forecasts in Europe, yields are going up. I mean, the how much up is a question of debate, but yields are going up. Forecast is that the bond will finally go positive. Unlike you guys sitting in America, we've been having negative yields for some time. Bond went to about minus 60. It has come back to about minus 25 right now. And the forecast is it is going to go well into positive territory next year. Now, that is going to kill fixed income returns across the board. So if you look at 2021, that will give you a good idea of what is going to happen in 2022. So in 2021, rates got absolutely murdered. So anything that is plain vanilla rates, so whether it is, you know, the bond or the gilt, or anything with a spread on top, in the sense if you are talking about Italy or Spain and so on, all of them negative returns. Now, if you go into credit, investment grade, where, you know, it is relatively low risk, the fundamentals have significantly improved in 2021, so spreads are tight, and as a result, there wasn't enough cushion. So investment grade in 2021 posted negative total returns, positive excess returns, but negative total returns. So what is the only place with positive total returns in European credit? I think in global credit, actually, is high yield. So if you look at Euro high yield had a bumper year in 2021, about 5.5% excess returns and about nearly 4% total returns. That's quite extraordinary, by the way, given what is going on elsewhere in the bond world. I think in 2022, you're going to have a very similar scenario. Rates are going to get killed again. Investment grade will be negative. In fact, probably more negative than 2021. High yield will be the only positive return territory. Probably less positive than 2021, but it will still be positive.
Mahesh, I'm wondering how the ECB plays into all of this, right? So they buy corporate bonds through their PEP program.
Very good question.
Their emergency asset purchase program.
So just to give some color to the people sitting in the U.S., the ECB has been buying corporate credit well before the pandemic. So the ECB has two programs. One is the Asset Purchase Program, APP, which is the standard QE, right? And then you got the emergency QE, which is the PEPP. The ECB has been buying corporate credit in the APP well before the PEPP came up. The PEPP actually buys less credit compared to the APP as a ratio. So the overall share of credit, for example, fell in 2021 compared to 2020 or, you know, 2019. ECB used to buy like 8.5% credit in QE, some months even 10, 12%. But once the emergency program came up, the share dropped to about 7.5, 8 in 2021. In 2022, what's going to happen is the ECB is going to taper down the PEPP program, which means the overall QE volume is going to drop. So forget credit share. Whatever the share, given that they're going to taper down the PEPP, you're going to end up with the ECB buying much less. So just to give you color, last year, 2021, the ECB bought about 80 billion euros net. So this year, in 2022, we forecast that the ECB will buy just about 38. So half of what they bought last year. Now, what's the implication? The implication is that the ECB will not be buying as much, both in primary and in secondary. So the implicit support is less compared to before. But there is one saving grace, though. The redemptions in the European corporate bond market are at a record high in 2022, which means the net supply in the corporate bond market is going to be much, much lower than 2021. So even though the ECB is going to buy a lot less than this year, in terms of percentage of net supply, right now it is about 90% of net supply. It will probably drop to about 2/3. So it's not that bad. It won't be half.
Right. Mahesh, give us a sense of new issuance, your expectations in 2022 from both investment grade and high yield.
A very good question. So if you talk about supply, 2021, gross supply in investment grade, obviously we had a near record. 2020 was much higher than 2021. But what happened in 2021 was the redemptions of prior issues are increasingly going up every year. So in 2021, particularly for corporates, means non-financials, particularly for corporates, net supply dropped from about 200 billion to just 40 billion. Can you believe that? It is one-fifth.
Mm. Yep. Wow.
One-fifth of what it was in 2020. Now, in 2022, we forecast that corporate net supply will probably slightly go up because, you know, yields are lower and so on. But financial net supply is going to drop a lot because redemptions are double than last year. So even though they're going to maintain a similar level of supply, remember, financial supply is largely regulatory. It's not opportunistic anymore, right? They've done all of that. So it generally tends to be very regulatory, which means they're not going to issue just because yields are cheap.
Mm-hmm.
So financial net supply is going to drop. Corporate net supply is going to slightly go up. So overall, investment grade net supply is going to be lower in 2022. That's a certainty. Now, if you talk about junk in 2021, we had an all-time record. Index-eligible net supply is about 110 billion euros. Remember, all of this is index-eligible, the numbers I talk about. They're all eligible for the Bloomberg indices. 110 billion. We expect that number to drop to about, you know, 85, 90 billion next year. It will still be a very good number on in line with 2019 and 20, but it will be below 2021 because yields are going to be wider and things are not going to be as hunky-dory as 2021.
All right, Mahesh, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate getting your thoughts on the European credit market. Mahesh Bimalingam, Bloomberg Intelligence Chief European Credit Strategist.
All right, coming up on the program, we're going to stay in Europe. What 2022 has in store for European banks as those interest rates do look set to be on the rise.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence via BI Go on the terminal. I'm Paul Sweeney.
And I'm Alex Steele. It is 25 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
All right, we'll be here each and every week at this time, tapping into our Bloomberg Intelligence analyst, covering some 2,000 companies and 130 industries worldwide.
We just talked about the European credit market when it comes to those higher rates. So let's get some perspective now on European banks. Jonathan Tice is Bloomberg Intelligence senior EU banks analyst. Okay, let's just do a what if. Let's pretend, for the sake of pretend, that you see rates actually sustainably rise over in Europe. So let's just pretend we're at a Bund yield around zero or a little bit below. What happens to these European banks? Do they actually start making some serious net interest margin?
Hello there. I think the first thing to say is we do need to distinguish in Europe between the UK and the European Union, the Eurozone, because rates are going to go up. They already have in December in the UK. And I think we over here will probably lead Europe and potentially the US higher earlier. And kind of consensus is looking at above 1% base rate by the end of this year. Europe's a lot harder to call. And then don't forget that, go back to 2011-12, the sovereign crisis, it isn't a one-way bet because, yes, the German economy's strong, France isn't too bad, but let's not forget Greece, let's not forget Portugal, let's not forget Italy. These are different speed economies with very different banking systems. So can the ECB raise rates at the moment? No, and they've been quite clear that they won't. Yields, on the other hand, they can rise, and that does help. If you look at Italian banks and you look at Spanish banks and Portuguese banks, 10 to 15% of their balance sheet is in sovereign debt. So clearly, if they can roll over into higher yielding sovereign debt, then that's a very big boost, especially from a low base, as we know most of these banks are.
So, Jonathan, as you talk to your institutional investor clients, where do you guys see the most opportunity this year in 2022? Do you go by country? How do you guys think about that?
Well, I think if you start from valuation and you start from consensus, it's the usual suspects that kind of stand out. It's the Barclays, the SocGens, the Santanders, the bigger international banks. I think if you want to play by country, you've got to get the country right first. And then, as ever, there are a couple of the higher beta names within that country. So I think investors are still a bit wary about the sector, albeit it isn't expensive yet, but it's had a good bounce. But I'll give you a good example. UniCredit, the market knew it had an investor day coming, was trading at the big discount to book value, comes out and says, tell you what, we are going to return 16 billion euros over the next 3 years to shareholders. May not sound like a lot when you think of Citigroup, but at the time of saying that, that was 60% of their market cap.
Yeah.
And funnily enough, the shares have bounced 30%. So what banks say? BNP selling Bank West for $16 billion. I was amazed on the day, and it only barely outperformed because the fact is it's getting out of an underperforming asset. It's got $6-7 billion of extra capital to return to shareholders. So there are plenty of things over in Europe. There are names can surprise positively in terms of capital return. Mm-hmm. And as I say, a headline number versus Citigroup or JP Morgan doesn't sound like big numbers, but these banks are a lot smaller these days.
Well, okay, but to that point, on a relative basis, why wouldn't you just go and own a JP Morgan that's just bigger and then pays that juicy dividend? Like, how much more upside do you think that these guys can have when they can deliver a payout that's smaller relatively, but for its own bank is quite large?
Well, don't forget, JP Morgan's several hundred billion dollars. So, I mean, Intesa, cash dividend yield is 8%.
That's pretty
good,
yeah.
The cash dividend yield you're getting from your US names is low single digit, and the buyback component's far bigger to keep earnings growth going. So it's a very different story. And if you get the name right, think BBVA. They sold their US business, and their shares doubled. If you look in Europe last year, SocGen's been one of our focus ideas a number of times. And, I mean, that thing doubled. UniCredit doubled. So we've got plenty of doublers trading with very high dividend yields and a big discount to book value, where if they focus on cost, if they dispose of an underperforming asset at a good price, it's very meaningful.
John, a name we've talked about a lot in the past, Deutsche Bank. Give us the latest there.
Well, I mean, as you know, Allison in the US covers Deutsche, but it continues to be an interesting story because think about fixed income, even though it's normalized, think about how their franchise has improved dramatically. So I wouldn't be surprised this year if we get back to talking about tie-ups. You've got Credit Suisse, which has had very well-known problems that everyone's thinking,
how do they reposition themselves strategically? Deutsche Bank, Commerzbank, there are another couple of names that I have no doubt we will be talking about numerous times over the next 6 to 12 months. But what they have done very well, they have delivered on cost. They focused on cost. He trimmed them to the beast. They've got a much better capital position now than they did have. So they are kind of fighting fit to either continue on in the same vein and just sort of grow organically, or actually look for something a bit more material by way of a merger. So it's a name that I think, if I was back on the sell side, I would feel comfortable having a reasonably sensible conversation with, whereas 2 to 3 years ago, you just didn't know where you stood. At least now you understand what the bank is. They've done a lot of the right things. As long as they don't go and pile back into equities and sort of repeat the mistakes we've seen cyclically in the past, then it's an interesting story.
I love that sentence. Like,
yes.
That was great. We know what the bank is. That's always a super solid thing. Jonathan, thanks so much. Really appreciate it. Jonathan Theis, Bloomberg Intelligence, Senior EU Banks Analyst.
Coming up on the program, Bitcoin futures ETFs have put SEC between a rock and a hard place. We're going to have more coming up.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies in 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 39 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
So let's continue the conversation of Europe and higher rates. We did banks, we did the credit market, now let's do REITs. In theory, if rates are super low, you're going to want to buy REITs and get a pickup in yield. So if rates actually start to rise, what happens to the European REIT market? Let's get more here with Sue Munden, Bloomberg Intelligence, a senior property analyst. Set the stage. How have European REITs done so far? What are the outperformers that's kind of set us up for this year?
So yes, last year was some recovery from the hit of the pandemic, which obviously affected the REITs significantly, particularly in office and retail, where rents weren't paid. But then on the flip side, the industrials and residential held up quite well. Mm. So we're at a situation as we go into 2022 where the pricing is really spread across industrials, some of which are more than 50% premium to their net assets, and some retail REITs, which are well below, some of them around the 40 to 50% below their net assets as at the last day that they were valued. So that sets us up for a situation going forward where obviously interest rates, I think if along consensus lines, are probably priced in. But if they're not, the sector as a whole, which is trading at minus 15%, could actually outperform, I believe, if the pandemic risks start unwinding, because that's much bigger effect on them than the interest rates. I say that for a number of reasons. Firstly, because most of the REITs have now financed their debt at fixed rates. So the rate effect will only come with refinancing, which does happen, but it will be much slower and much more drawn out and enable them to react to it better. And the second thing is that there is an enormous yield gap, enormous I mean in terms of relative to historic levels, between the yields on REITs and the yields on treasuries. And so there is a big possibility that as long as there are underlying risks in the sector, that gap could narrow as the interest rates rise.
So I don't know how it is in London, but here in New York, there is a lot of folks that are still working from home, and I'm not sure if or when they're coming back, and that means there's a lot of empty corporate office space around. How's the office REIT market looking in 2022?
What is happening that we've seen very much in the last quarters, closing quarters of last year, is that there is a lot of investment demand for offices that are environmentally friendly and flexible. And so the prices actually were very robust at the end of last year. But obviously what's happening on the other side is that secondhand property, property that's not environmentally friendly, that's not being refurbished, is seeing much higher vacancy. Vacancy in London went up north of 7 or 8% for secondhand property towards the end of last year. So I think looking into 2022, we're going to see that exacerbated probably a little bit more. I'm quite concerned, actually, about the fact that because rent is actually for office users, one of the smaller costs, labor is typically by far the largest cost, and that the properties are on long leases, that the chief operating officers are probably sitting there and just saying, well, actually, I don't need to deal with the rent right now. I need to work out how I'm going to get my staff happy. So that might mean moving to better property, or it could just mean that they're just going to stay put and revamp the office a bit until such time as they actually have to address it. And that means we may kick the can down the road a little.
You also mentioned something interesting about environmentally friendly office space and such. And so I'm interested as to how you think carbon footprints are going to move the needle on REIT's performances.
I think that tenants are deciding very, very quickly that they've got to get themselves into shape for 2030 net carbon zero. And therefore, they want to rent out space that meets those demands or will do by 2030. And if you consider the fact that a lot of offices are rented out on 10 or 15 year leases, obviously that's now less than 10 years away. So they have to look at that very carefully. And it seems to me there's a bit of an imbalance between, you know, the rate that you can upgrade your property and the rate at which tenants can decide that they want something only that's climate friendly. And if you're in a situation where your office workers can do that from home, they don't actually have to be in office space, then you're just going to scale down a lot. So until you can just get the right space that's really good quality.
Sue, just real quickly, what do you think is the best sector in terms of REITs that'll performance-wise in 2022? Past, it's been, you know, storage, for example, was a great sector for REITs.
Exactly, yes. Yes, SEGRO, one of the largest warehouse REITs, was up over 50% in 2021. But this year, because they are now priced for performance, they may just perform in line with their underlying growth, which may be 20%. We've got some catch-up to do for retail. Offices looked fairly well-priced to me as well, but retail, if pandemic restrictions start reversing, then I think we could see some catch-up there, which would help them. So it's really a bit of a balance. Your safe bet has always been to look at the better-performing ones like the industrials on the fundamental line.
Sue, we really appreciate it. Sue Munden, Bloomberg Intelligence, Senior Property Analyst. Thank you very much.
All right. Two of the hotter areas in finance, I would say, are number one, Bitcoin, and number two, ETFs. So the smart kids in the market said, let's have a Bitcoin-based ETF. And we kind of got one of those. And that makes the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, they've got some work to do to kind of regulate this whole side of the business. Let's bring in James Seifert. He covers all things crypto and from the legal side for Bloomberg Intelligence. So, James, talk to us about what you think the SEC needs to do here, because a lot of folks are saying, I really want a ETF that's not based on futures, but it's based on a real thing.
Yeah, so there's a whole bunch of legal rules and minutia going on in the back end here. But for the most part, my team and I believe that for everyone involved, the spot Bitcoin ETF would be basically the best solution. But the SEC has been against that since the Winklevoss twins filed for an ETF all the way back in 2013. And they've been denying them for 8+ years at this point. And it looks like they're going to continue denying them through 2022. But as you mentioned, we did get futures ETFs approved by the SEC, although through a different manner, a specific type of ETF called the 1940 Act ETF. And basically what that did is it made for these filers didn't have to go through a certain process called the 19b4. And the spot Bitcoin ETFs would have to go through a 19b4 process to get approval to list on an exchange.
So if I'm an investor, what's the distinction for me? Like, what do I get?
For the most part, it doesn't matter to the end investor. The reason that these futures ETFs can be filed in the 1933 Act or the 1940 Act solely comes back to the way that the treasuries are classified in the portfolio. They're classified as securities. They meet these diversification requirements to be held under the 40 Act, which is like higher requirements. And there was a rule change that was adopted in 2019 that basically said 1940 Act ETFs don't have to go through this 19b4 approval process. But for all intents and purposes, if you're buying a futures ETF and one is a 33 Act and a 40 Act, they could basically be offering the exact same thing. It's just about the process to get approved. So that's why the futures ETFs were approved under the 1940 Act back in October of 21.
So, James, there is a new sheriff on Wall Street, Gary Gensler, the chair of the SEC. What do we know about his view of crypto?
Yeah, so I mean, if you talk to crypto enthusiasts and people that solely operate in the crypto world, they think he's the devil. But honestly, he taught a blockchain. He taught a blockchain and crypto and Bitcoin class at MIT. I mean, this guy knows what he's talking about. He has bosses that he has to report to, and he's following the laws and regulation that's set before him. I just view it that he's kind of lost the forest for the trees here. As I mentioned, he's following the laws and regulations and focusing on the minutia and not focusing on the big picture that this will be better for everyone involved. So they've put their foot in the ground. They're not going to launch a Bitcoin ETF until there's some regulatory oversight. There's some surveillance agreements with underlying exchanges, but there's a lot of holes to be poked in that. And we're going to see more of that come to fruition in the spring of this year.
Do we have a sense of the kind of investors that would be in the ETF market? I was talking to a guy yesterday, and he was basically saying, like, hedge funds are either, like, all in like, an insane way, or they're totally freaked out and not in at all. And I wonder, like, the role that the ETF world can play in the kind of bridging that huge chasm.
Yeah, so this is a pretty complex question, one I get from people all the time. There are people in the crypto world and the financial asset management world that don't think there's any reason to have an ETF because anyone can open an account and buy cryptocurrency, really. Like, anyone can open an account and buy Bitcoin, especially in the U.S. But what this does is the ETF wrapper democratizes a bunch of things. So, for instance, if you're going to be buying crypto directly, you're going to be paying a transaction fee, commission fees, which obviously now we don't do that in ETFs anymore. And then the other side of it is it kind of opens to a new world of investors. So if you're looking at advisors, they hold, I don't know, 25 trillion. There's an estimate about 25 trillion in the U.S. An ETF would open this this world to them. So if they have a bunch of clients and they're thinking about putting, I don't know, 1%, maybe 5% of their clients' assets into a Bitcoin fund, they don't want to be opening all these other accounts and have to deal with buying Bitcoin directly. So it'd be much easier just to buy an approved, SEC-approved Bitcoin ETF. Now, we have the futures ETF that's already available, as I mentioned, but it's not the most efficient long-term vehicle. There are roll costs to holding futures because you're constantly got to buy the next month contract and sell the current month contract, and there's costs to doing that. I mean, this thing has been out for less than 3 months, and it's already underperforming Bitcoin by 3%. So there's issues there. A spot Bitcoin ETF would theoretically not have those issues and would just kind of open the world to the asset management industry that is currently a little bit closed off. There are avenues for people to get access. There's new ways being built, but an ETF just makes things a lot easier for a lot of different people.
All right, James Seyfert, Bloomberg Intelligence Alternative Investments Analyst, thank you so very much.
That's this week's edition of Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
And remember, you can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BIGO on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 57 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.